Mythical Monsters, or When Behemoths Ruled, Lore versus Cataclysmic Extinction, by Charles Gould. An Adult Brain audiobook production, read to you by Graham Dunlop. Preface. The author has to express his great obligations to many gentlemen who have assisted him in the preparation of this volume, either by affording access to their libraries, or by furnishing or revising translations from the Chinese, etc. And he must especially tender them to J. Haas, Esquire, the Austro-Hungarian vice-consul at Shanghai, to Mr. Thomas Kingsmill and the Rev. W. Holt of Shanghai, to Mr. Falconer of Hong Kong, and to Dr. N. B. Dennys of Singapore. For the sake of uniformity, the author has endeavored to reduce all the romanized representations of Chinese sounds to the system adopted by S. W. Williams, whose invaluable dictionary is the most available one for students. No alteration, however, has been made when quotations from eminent sinologues like Legge have been inserted. Should the present volume prove sufficiently interesting to attract readers, a second one will be issued at a future date, in continuation of the subject. June 1884. Note by the publishers. The publishers think it right to state that, owing to the author's absence in China, the work has not had the advantage of his supervision in its passage through the press. It is also proper to mention that the MS left the author's hand 18 months ago. 13 Waterloo Place, SW, January 1886. Introduction. It would have been a bold step indeed for anyone some 30 years ago to have thought of treating the public to a collection of stories ordinarily reputed fabulous, and of claiming for them the consideration due to genuine realities, or to have advocated tales time-honored as fictions, as actual facts, and those of the nursery as being in many instances legends, more or less distorted, descriptive of real beings or events. Nowadays, it is a less hazardous proceeding. The great era of advanced opinion initiated by Darwin, which has seen, in the course of a few years, a larger progress in knowledge in all departments of science than decades of centuries preceding it, has, among other changes, worked a complete revolution in the estimation of the value of folklore, and speculations on it, which in the days of our boyhood would have been considered as puerile, are now admitted to be not merely interesting, but necessary to those who endeavor to gather up the skeins of unwritten history, and to trace the antecedents and early migrations from parent sources of nations long since alienated from each other by customs, speech, and space. I have, therefore, but little hesitation in gravely proposing to submit that many of these so-called mythical animals, which throughout long ages and in all nations have been the fertile subjects of fiction and fable, come legitimately within the scope of plain matter-of-fact natural history, and that they may be considered not as the outcome of exuberant fancy, but as creatures which really once existed, and of which, unfortunately, only imperfect and inaccurate descriptions have filtered down to us, probably very much refracted through the mists of time. I propose to follow, for a certain distance only, the path which has been pursued in the treatment of myths by mythologists, so far only, in fact, as may be necessary to trace out the homes and origin of those stories which in their later dress are incredible, deviating from it to dwell upon the possibility of their having preserved to us, through the medium of unwritten natural history, traditions of creatures once coexisting with man, some of which are so weird and terrible as to appear at first sight to be impossible. I propose stripping them of those supernatural characters with which a mysteriously implanted love of the wonderful has invested them, and to examine them, as at the present day we are fortunately able to do, by the lights of modern sciences of geology, evolution, and philology. For me, the major part of these creatures are not chimeras, but objects of rational study. The dragon, in place of being a creature evolved out of the imagination of Aryan man by the contemplation of lightning flashing through the caverns which he tenanted, as is held by some mythologists, is an animal once lived and dragged its ponderous coils, and perhaps flew, which devastated herds, and on occasion swallowed their shepherd, which, establishing its lair in some cavern overlooking the fertile plain, spread terror and destruction around, and protected from assault by dread or superstitious feeling, may even have been subsidized by the terror-stricken peasantry, who, failing the power to destroy it, may have preferred tethering offerings of cattle adjacent to its cavern to having it come down to seek supplies from amongst their midst. This tributary offering is a common feature in dragon legends. A good example is that given by El Idrisi in his History of the Dragon Destroyed by Alexander the Great in the island of Mostachin, one of the Canaries. To me, the specific existence of the unicorn seems not incredible and, in fact, more probable than the history which assigns it its origin to a lunar myth. The latest writer on this point summarizes his views in his opening remarks as follows.
The science of heraldry has faithfully preserved to modern times various phases of some of those remarkable legends which, based upon a study of natural phenomena, exhibit the process whereby the greater part of mythology has come into existence. Thus we find the solar griffin, the solar phoenix, the demi-eagle displayed issuing from flames of fire, the solar lion and the lunar unicorn, which two latter noble creatures now harmoniously support the royal arms. I propose in the following pages to examine the myth of the unicorn, the wild, white, fierce, chaste moon, whose two horns, unlike those of mortal creatures, are indissolubly twisted into one. The creature that endlessly fights with the lion to gain the crown or summit of heaven, which neither may retain, and whose brilliant horn drives away the darkness and evil of the night, even as we find in the myth that venom is defended by the horn of the unicorn.
The Unicorn, Mythological Investigation, Robert Brown, Jun, FSA, London, 1881. Again, believing as I do in the existence of some great undescribed inhabitants of the ocean depths, the much-derided sea serpent, whose home seems especially to be adjacent to Norway, I recognize this monster as originating the myths of the Midgard serpent which the Norse elder Eddas have collected, this being the contrary view to that taken by mythologists, who invert the derivation and suppose the stories current among the Norwegian fishermen to be modified versions of this important element of Norse mythology. The Midgard, or world serpent, we have already become tolerably well acquainted with and recognize in him the wild, tumultuous sea. Thor contended with him, begot him on his hook, but did not succeed, page 4, in killing him. We also remember how Thor tried to lift him in the form of a cat. The North abounds in stories about the sea serpent, which are nothing but variations of the original myths of the Eddas. Odin cast him into the sea where he shall remain until he is conquered by Thor in Ragnarok. Norse Mythology, page 387, R. B. Anderson, Chicago, 1879. I must admit that, for my part, I doubt the general derivation of myths from the contemplation of the visible workings of external nature. Vide Anderson. It seems to me easier to suppose that the palsy of time has enfeebled the utterance of these oft-told tales until their original appearance is almost unrecognizable. That the uncultured savages should possess powers of imagination and poetical invention far beyond those enjoyed by the most instructed nations of the present day. Less hard to believe that these wonderful stories of gods and demigods, of giants and dwarfs, of dragons and monsters of all descriptions are transformations than to believe them all to be inventions. Just as even the greatest masters of fiction adapt but do not originate, Harold Skimpole and Wilkins Micawber sat unconsciously for their portraits in real life, and the most charming characters and fertile plots produced by that most prolific of all writers, A. Dumas, are mere elaborations of people and incidents with which historical memoirs provided him. The author of Atlantis indeed claims that the gods and goddesses of the ancient Greeks, the Phoenicians, the Hindus, and the Scandinavians were simply the kings, queens, and heroes of Atlantis, and the acts attributed to them in mythology a confused recollection of real historical events. Atlantis, the Antediluvian World by Donnelly, New York, 1882. The author has amassed with untiring labor a large amount of evidence to prove that the island of Atlantis, in place of being a myth or fable of Plato, really once existed, was the source of all modern arts and civilization, and was destroyed in a catastrophe which he identifies with the biblical deluge. Without conceding the locus of the originals, which requires much greater examination than I am able to make at the present time, I quite agree with him as to the principle. I believe that the mythological deities represent a confused chronology of far distant times, and that the destruction of the Nemean lion, the Lernaean hydra, and the Minotaur are simply the records of acts of unusual bravery in combating ferocious animals. On the first landing of Pizarro, the Mexicans entertained the opinion that man and horse were parts of one strange animal, and we have thus a clue to the explanation of the origin of the belief in centaurs from a distant view of horsemen, a view possibly followed by the immediate flight of the observer, which rendered a solution of the extraordinary phenomenon impossible. So also Father Stanislaus Arlet of the Society of Jesus, writing to the general of the society in 1698, respecting a new mission in Peru, and speaking of a Peruvian tribe calling themselves Kinesian, says,
"Having never before seen horses or men resembling us in color and dress, the astonishment they showed at our first appearance among them was a very pleasing spectacle to us, the sight of us terrifying them to such a degree that the bows and arrows fell from their hand, imagining, as they afterwards owned, that the man, his hat, his clothes, and the horse he rode upon composed but one animal."
On the credibility of remarkable stories, Ferdinand Mendez Pinto quaintly observes in one of his earlier chapters,
"I will not speak of the Palace Royal, because I saw it but on the outside. Howbeit the Chinese tell such wonders of it as would amaze a man. For it is my intent to relate nothing save what we beheld here with our own eyes. And that was so much as that I am afraid to write it, not that it would seem strange to those who had seen and read the marvels of the kingdom of China, but because I doubt that they which would compare those wondrous things that are in the countries they have not seen with that little they have seen in their own will make some question of it, or, it may be, give no credit at all to these truths, because they are not conformable to their understanding and small experience."
The Voyages and Adventures of Ferdinand Mendez Pinto, done into English by H. C. Gent, London, 1653, page 109. The vindication of Pinto's reputation for veracity will doubtless one day be, to a great extent, effected. For although his interesting narrative is undoubtedly embroidered with a rich tissue of falsity, due apparently to an exaggerated credulity upon his part and systematic deception upon that of his Chinese informants, he certainly is undeserving of the wholesale condemnation which Congreve was the reflex when he made Foresight, addressing Sir Sampson Legend, say, "Thou modern Mandeville, Ferdinand Mendez Pinto was a type of thee, though liar of the first magnitude." Love for Love, Act 2, Scene 1. There are many points in his narrative which are corroborated by history and the accounts of other voyages. And it must be remembered that although the major part of the names of places and persons which he gives are now unrecognizable, yet this may be due to alterations from the lapse of time, and from the difficulty of recognizing the true original Chinese or Japanese word under those produced by the foreign mode of transliteration in vogue in those days. Thus the Port Liempu of Pinto is now and has been for many years past only known as Ningpo, the first name being a term of convenience used by the early Portuguese voyagers and long since abandoned. Just as the wonderful Quince of Marco Polo, still known by that name in Pinto's time, has been only successfully identified with Hang Chau Fu through the antiquarian research of Colonel Yule, so also the titles of Chams, Teutons, Chumbins, Aitons, and Chakis, which Pinto refers to, page 108, are only with difficulty recognizable in those respectively of Tsitsang, a Manchu governor, Tutong, lieutenant general, Tsung Ping, brigadier general, Tao Tai, intendant of circuit, and Gan Cha, a Sheze, provincial judge, as rendered by the modern sinologue Myers in his essay on the Chinese government, Shanghai, 1878. The incidental references to the country, people, habits, and products contained in the chapter describing his passage in captivity from Nanquin to Pekin are true to nature, and the apparently obviously untruthful statement which he makes to the employment by the king of Tartary of thousands of rhinoceri, both as beasts of burden and articles of food, page 158, is explicable. I think, on the supposition that some confusion has arisen, either in translation or transcription, between rhinoceros and camel. Anyone who has seen the long strings of camels wending their way from Peking to the various northern roads through the passes into Mongolia would readily believe, page 7, that a large transport corp of them could easily be amassed by a despotic monarch, while the vast numbers of troops to which Pinto makes reference are confirmed by more or less authentic histories. Now, as some of the creatures whose existence I shall have to contend for in these volumes are objects of derision to a large proportion of mankind, and of reasonable doubt to another, I cannot help fortifying myself with some such outwork of reasoning as the pith of Pinto's remarks affords, and supplementing it by adding that, while the balance between skepticism and credulity is undoubtedly always difficult to hold, yet, as Lord Bacon well remarks,
there is nothing makes a man suspect more than to know little, and therefore men should remedy suspicion by procuring to know more.
Whatley extends Bacon's proposition by adding,
this is equally true of the suspicions that have reference to things as persons.
In other words, ignorance and suspicion go hand in hand, and so travelers' tales, even when supported by good evidence, are mostly denied credence or accepted with repugnance, when they offend the experience of those who, remaining at home, are thus only partially educated. Hence it is, not to go too far back for examples, that we have seen Bruce, Mungo Park, Du Chalu, Gordon Cumming, Schliemann, and Stanley treated with the most ungenerous criticism and contemptuous disbelief by persons who, however well informed in many subjects, lacked the extended and appreciative views which can only be acquired by travel. I was myself an eyewitness of two such discoveries and helped to gather the articles together. The slanderers have long since been silenced, who were not ashamed to charge the discoverer with an imposture. Professor Virchow in Appendix 1 to Schliemann's Ilios Murray, 1880. Nor is this incredulity limited to travelers' tales about savage life. It is just as often displayed in reference to the surroundings of uneventful life, provided they are different from those with which we are familiar. Saladin rebuked the Knight of the Leopard for falsehood when the latter assured him that the waters of lakes in his own country became at times solidified, so that armed and mounted knights could cross them as if on dry land. And the wise Indian who was taken down to see the large American cities, with the expectation that, being convinced of the resources and irresistible power of civilization, he would influence his tribe to submission on his return, to the surprise of the commissioners who had conveyed him, spoke in directly contrary terms to those expected of him, privately explaining in reply to their remonstrances that had he told the truth to his tribe, he would have been indelibly branded for the remainder of his life as an outrageous and contemptible liar. Chinese students dispatched for education in American or European capitals are compelled on their return to make similar reservations, under pain of incurring a like penalty. And officials who, from contact with Europeans at the open ports, get their ideas expanded too quickly, are said to be liable to isolation in distant regions, where their advanced and fantastic opinions may do as little harm to right-thinking people as possible. But ask them to credit an electric telegram, to understand a steam engine, to acknowledge the microscopic revelation spread out before their eyes, to put faith in the Atlantic cable or the East India House, and they will tell you that you are a barbarian with blue eyes, a Fankwe, and a sayer of that which is not. The dragon and the phoenix are true, but the rotifer and the message, the 60 miles an hour, the cable, and the captive kings are false. Household words, October 30th, 1855. Even scientific men are sometimes as crassly incredulous as the uncultured masses. On this point, hear Mr. A. R. Wallace. Address delivered to the biological section of the British Association, Glasgow, 1876.
Many now living remember the time, for it is little more than 20 years ago, when the antiquity of man as now understood was universally discredited. Not only theologians, but even geologists taught us that man belonged to the existing state of things, that the extinct animals of the tertiary period had finally disappeared, and that the Earth's surface had assumed its present condition before the human race first came into existence. So prepossessed were scientific men with this idea, which yet rested on purely negative evidence and could not be supported by any argument of scientific value, that numerous facts which had been presented at intervals for half a century, all tending to prove the existence of man at very remote epochs, were silently ignored. And more than this, the detailed statements of three distinct and careful observers confirming each other were rejected by a great scientific society as too improbable for publication, only because they proved, if they were true, the coexistence of man with extinct animals.
In 1854, a communication from the Torquay Natural History Society, confirming previous accounts by Mr. Goodwin Austin, Mr. Vivian, and the Reverend Mr. McHenry, that worked flints occurred in Kent's Hole with remains of extinct species, was rejected as too improbable for publication. The travels of that faithful historian Marco Polo were for a long time considered as fables, and the graphic descriptions of the Abbe Huc even still find detractors continuing the role of those who maintain that he had never even visited the countries which he described. Gordon Cumming was disbelieved when he asserted that he had killed an antelope out of a herd with a rifle shot at a distance of 800 yards. Madame Marion was accused of deliberate falsehood in reference to her description of a bird eating spider nearly 200 years ago. She is set down a thorough heretic, not at all to be believed, a manufacturer of unsound natural history, an inventor of false facts in science. Goss, Romance of Nat Hist, 2nd Series, page 227. But nowadays, Mr. Bates and other reliable observers have confirmed it in regard to South America, India, and elsewhere. Audubon was similarly accused by botanists of having invented the yellow water lily, which he figured in his Birds of the South under the name of Nymphaea lutea, and after having lain under the imputation for years, was confirmed at last by the discovery of the long-lost flower in Florida by Mrs. Mary Trent in the summer of 1876. And this encourages us to hope that someday or other a fortunate sportsman may rediscover the Halatus Washingtoni, in regard to which Dr. Cover says,
"That famous bird of Washington was a myth. Either Audubon was mistaken or else, as some do not hesitate to affirm, he lied about it."
Pop Sci Monthly, number 60, April 1877. Figure 1, fisherman attacked by octopus. Facsimile from a drawing by Hokusai, a celebrated Japanese artist who lived about the beginning of the present century. Victor Hugo was ridiculed for having exceeded the bounds of poetic license when he produced his marvelous word painting of the devilfish and described a man as becoming its helpless victim. The thing was derided as a monstrous impossibility. Yet, within a few years, were discovered on the shores of Newfoundland cuttlefishes with arms extending to 30 feet in length, and capable of dragging a good-sized boat beneath the surface. And their action has been reproduced for centuries past as the representation of a well-known fact in net souks, ivory carvings and illustrations by Japanese artists.
By the kindness of my friend Mr. Bartlett, I have been enabled to examine a most beautiful Japanese carving in ivory, said to be 150 years old, and called by the Japanese net souki or toggle. These toggles are handed down from one generation to the next, and they record any remarkable event that happens to any member of the family. This carving is 1.5 inches long and about as big as a walnut. It represents a lady in a quasi-leaning attitude, and at first sight it is difficult to perceive what she is doing. But after a while, the details come out magnificently. The unfortunate lady has been seized by an octopus when bathing, for the lady wears a bathing dress. One extended arm of the octopus is in the act of coiling around the lady's neck, and she is endeavoring to pull it off with her right hand. Another arm of the sea monster is entwined round the left wrist, while the hand is fiercely tearing at the mouth of the brute. The other arms of the octopus are twined around, grasping the lady's body and waist. In fact, her position reminds one very much of Laocoon in the celebrated Statue of the Snakes, seizing him and his two sons. The sucking discs of the octopus are carved exactly as they are in nature, and the color of the body of the creature, together with the formidable aspect of the eye, are wonderfully represented. The face of this Japanese lady is most admirably done. It expresses the utmost terror and alarm, and possibly may be a portrait. So carefully is the carving executed, the lady's white teeth can be seen between her lips. The hair is a perfect gem of work. It is jet black, extended down the back, and tied at the end in a knot. In fact, it is so well done that I can hardly bring myself to think that it is not real hair, fastened on in some most ingenious manner. But by examining it under a powerful magnifying glass, I find it is not so. It is the result of extraordinary cleverness in carving. The back of the little white comb fixed into the thick of the black hair adds to the effect of this magnificent carving of the hair. I congratulate Mr. Bartlett on the acquisition of this most beautiful curiosity. There is an inscription in Japanese characters on the underneath part of the carving, and Mr. Bartlett and myself would, of course, only be too glad to get this translated. Frank Buckland in Land and Water. Before the days of Darwinism, what courage was requisite in a man who propounded any theory a little bit extravagant? Hark how even less than 20 years ago, the ghost of the unfortunate Lord Monboddo had bricks of criticism pelted at it, half earnestly, half contemptuously, by one of our greatest thinkers, whose thought happened to run in grooves different from those traveled in by the mind of the unfortunate Scotman.
Lord Monboddo had just finished his great work, by which he derives all mankind from a couple of apes, and all the dialects of the world from a language originally framed by some Egyptian gods, when the discovery of Sanskrit came on him like a thunderbolt. It must be said, however, to his credit, that he at once perceived the immense importance of the discovery. He could not be expected to sacrifice his primordial monkeys or his Egyptian idols, etc.
Max Müller, Science of Language, 4th edition, page 163-165, London, 1864. And again,
it may be of interest to give one other extract in order to show how well, apart from his men with and his monkeys without tails, Lord Monboddo could sift and handle the evidence that was placed before him.
Max Müller also furnishes us with an amazing example of skepticism on the part of Dugald Stewart. He says,
however, if the facts about Sanskrit were true, Dugald Stewart was too wise not to see that the conclusions drawn from them were inevitable. He therefore denied the reality of such a language as Sanskrit altogether, and wrote his famous essay to prove that Sanskrit had been put together after the model of Greek and Latin, by whose arch forgers and liars, the Brahmins, and that the whole of Sanskrit literature was an imposition.
Science of Language, page 168. So Ctesias attacked Herodotus. The very existence of Homer has been denied, and even the authorship of Shakespeare's plays questioned. When a naturalist, either by visiting such spots of earth as are still out of the way, or by his good fortune, finds a very queer plant or animal, he is forthwith accused of inventing his game, the word not being used in its old sense of discovery, but in its modern of creation. As soon as the creature is found to sin against preconception, the great misguiding spirit, a priori by name, who furnishes philosophers with their omniscience, pro renata, whispers that no such thing can be, and forthwith there is a charge of hoax. The heavens themselves have been charged with hoaxes. When Le Verrier and Adams predicted a planet by calculation, it was gravely asserted in some quarters that the planet which had been calculated was not the planet, but another which had clandestinely and improperly got into the neighborhood of the true body. The disposition to suspect hoax is stronger than the disposition to hoax. Who was it that first announced that the classical writings of Greece and Rome were one huge hoax perpetrated by the monks, in what the announcer would be as little or less inclined than Dr. Maitland to call the Dark Ages? Macmillan, 1860. We are all familiar enough now with the Black Swan, but Ovid considered it as so utterly impossible that he clinched, as it were, an affirmation by saying,
"If I doubted, O Maximus, of thy approval of these words, I could believe that there are swans of the color of Memnon,"
i.e. black, and even so late as the days of Sir Thomas Browne, we find them classed by him with flying horses, hydras, centaurs, harpies, and satyrs as monstrosities, rarities, or else poetical fancies. Poetic Epistles, Book 3, Ep 3, and Rara Avis Interis, Nigroque Similima Cungno. Now that we have all seen the great hippopotamus disport himself in the tank in the gardens of the Zoological Society, we can smile at the grave arguments of the savant who, while admitting the existence of the animal, disputed the possibility of his walking about on the bed of a river, because his great bulk would prevent his rising again. Having showed the foregoing description of the mountain cow called by the Spaniards Ante Manati to a person of honor, he was pleased to send it to a learned person in Holland. This learned person discusses it and compares it with the hippopotamus, and winds up by saying, in reference to a description of the habits of the hippopotamus, as noticed at Loango by Captain Rogers, to the effect that when they are in the water, they will sink to the bottom and then walk as on dry ground. But what he says of her sinking to the bottom in deep rivers and walking there, if he adds, what I think he supposes, that it rises again and comes on the land, I much question. For that such a huge body should raise itself up again, though I know whales and great fish can do, transcends the faith of J.H. F. J. Napton, Collection of Voyages, Volume 2, Part 2, page 13, 4 vols, London, 1729. But I dare say it passed muster in his days as a very sound and shrewd observation, just as possibly, but for the inconvenient waggery of Peter Pindar, might have done the intelligent inquiry which he records after the seam in the apple dumpling. Poor Fray Gaspar de Jean Bernardin, who in 1611 undertook the journey by land from India to Portugal, was unfortunate enough to describe the mode in which the captain of the caravan communicated intelligence to Baghdad by carrier pigeon.
"He had pigeons whose young and nests were at his house in that city, and every 2 days he let a pigeon fly with a letter tied to its foot containing the news of his journey. This account met with but little belief in Europe, and was treated there as a matter of merriment."
Historical Account of Discoveries and Travels in Asia, Hugh Murray, FRSE, 3 vols, 8 vo, Edinburgh, 1820. The discredit under which this traveler fell is the more surprising because the same custom had already been noted by Sir John Mandeville, who, in speaking of Syria and adjacent countries, says,
"In that country and other countries beyond, they have custom, when they shall use and wear, and when men hold in siege about in city or castle, and they within dare not send in messengers with letters fro lord to lord, for to ask succour, they make in here letters and bind in him to the neck of a culver and let in the culver flee, and the culverin been so taught that they fun with the letters to the very place that men would send them to, for the culver's been norisic in the places where they've been sent to. and they sending them there. For to Baron hear letters, and the culvers return them again, whereas they been norisk, and so they do commonly.
While long before Pliny had referred to it in his natural history as follows.
In addition to this, pigeons have acted as messengers in affairs of importance. During the siege of Mutina, Decimus Brutus, who was in the town, sent dispatches to the camp of the consuls, fastened to pigeons' feet. Of what use to Antony, then, were his entrenchments, and all the vigilance of the besieging army, his nets, too, which he had spread in the river while the messenger of the besieged was cleaving the air?
Book 10, Chapter 53. The pace of railways, steam communication across the Atlantic, the Suez Canal, were not all these considered in former days to be impossible? A writer in Macmillan's magazine in 1860 concludes a series of objections to the canal as follows. And the emperor must hesitate to identify himself with an operation which might not impossibly come to be designated by posterity as Napoleon's folly. With these examples of failure of judgment before us, it may be fairly asked whether, in applying our minds to the investigation of the reality of creatures apparently monstrous, we duly reflect upon the extraordinary, almost miraculous, events which incessantly occur in the course of the short existence of all animated nature. Supposing the history of insects were unknown to us, could the wildest imagination conceive such a marvelous transformation as that which takes place continually around us in the passage from the larva, through the chrysalis, to the butterfly? Or human ingenuity invent one so bizarre as that recorded by Steenstrup in his theory of the alternation of generation? We accept as nothing marvelous only because we see them daily, the organization and the polity of a community of ants. Their collaboration, their wars, and their slaveries have been so often stated that they cease to astonish. The same may be said of the marvelous architecture of birds, their construction of houses to live in, of bowers to play in, and even of gardens to gratify their sense of beauty. The bower bird, Tilinor hincus holocericeus, and the garden-building bird of New Guinea, Amblyornis internara. We admire the ingenious imagination of Swift, and essayists dwell upon his happy conceits and upon the ability with which, in his celebrated work, he has ordered all things to harmonize in dimensions with the enlarged and reduced scales on which he has conceived the men and animals of Brobdingnag and Lilliput. So much even has this quaint idea been appreciated that his story has achieved a small immortality and proved one of the numerous springs from which new words have been imported into our language. Yet the peculiar and essential singularities of the story are quite equaled or even surpassed by creatures which are, or have been, found in nature. The imaginary diminutive cows which Gulliver brought back from Lilliput and placed in the meadows at Dulwich are not one bit more remarkable in respect to relative size than the pygmy elephant, E. falconeri, whose remains have been found in the cave deposits of Malta, associated with those of the pygmy hippopotami, and which was only 2 feet inches high, or the still-existing hippopotamus, Corupsus liberiensis, which Monsieur Milne Edwardes figures as little more than 2 feet in height. Recherches, etc. de Mammiferes, Plate 1, Paris, 1868 to 1874. The Lilliputian forests from which the Royal Navy was constructed contained even large trees in comparison with the dwarf oaks of Mexico, or with the allied, even smaller species which crawls like heather about the hill slopes of China and Japan, and still more so in comparison with that singular pine, the most diminutive known. Dacrydium taxifolium, fruiting specimens of which, according to Kirk, are sometimes only 2 inches high, while the average height is only 6 to 10 inches. While even among the forests of Brobdingnag, a very respectable position could be held by the mammoth trees of California, Sequoia gigantea, or by the loftier white gums of Australia, Eucalyptus amygdalina. which occasionally reach, according to von Mueller, the enormous height of 480 feet. This obstacle was a forest of oaks, not giant oaks, but the very reverse, a forest of dwarf oaks, Quercus nana. Far as the eye could reach extended the singular wood, in which no tree rose above 30 inches in height. Yet it was no thicket, no undergrowth of shrubs, but a true forest of oaks, each tree having its separate stem, its boughs, its lobed leaves, and its bunches of brown acorns. Captain Mayne Reed, The War Trail, Chapter 64. Respecting the timber trees of this tract, Dr. Ferdinand von Mueller, the government botanist, thus writes, "At the desire of the writer of these passages, Mr. D. Bogle measured a fallen tree of Eucalyptus amygdalina in the deep recesses of Dandenong and obtained for it a length of 420 feet, which proportions of width indicate in a design of monumental structure placed in the exhibition. While Mr. G. Klein took the measurement of a eucalyptus on the Black Spur 10 miles distant from Healysville, 480 feet high, in the state forest of Dandenong, it was found by actual measurement that an acre of ground contained 20 large trees of an apparent average height of about 350 feet. R. Bro Smith, The Gold Fields of Victoria, Melbourne, 1869. Nor could more adequate tenants, in point of size, be found to occupy them than the gigantic reptilian forms lately discovered by Marsh among the deposits of Colorado and Texas. Surely a profound acquaintance with the different branches of natural history should render a man credulous rather than incredulous, for there is hardly conceivable a creature so monstrous that it may not be paralleled by existing ones in everyday life. In the next place, we must remember how impossible it is for the mind to invent an entirely new fact. There is nothing in the mind of man that has not pre-existed in nature. Can we imagine a person who never saw or heard of an elephant drawing a picture of such a two-tailed creature?" J. Donnelly, Ragnarok, page 119, New York, 1883. Figure 2 is a pterodactylus, after Figier. Are the composite creatures of Chaldean mythology so very much more wonderful than the marsupial kangaroo, the duck-billed platypus, and the flying lizard of Malaysia, which are, or the pterodactylus, Ramphornicus, and Archaeopteryx, which have been? Does not geological science day by day trace one formation by easy gradation to another, bridge over the gaps which formerly separated them, carry the proofs of the existence of man constantly further and further back into remote time, and disclose the previous existence of intermediate types, satisfying the requirements of the Darwinian theory, connecting the great divisions of the animal kingdom of reptile-like birds and bird-like reptiles? Figure 3 is a Ramphornicus from nature. Can we suppose that we have at all exhausted the great museum of nature? Have we, in fact, penetrated yet beyond its antechambers? Figure 4 is Archaeopteryx. Does the written history of man comprising a few thousand years embrace the whole course of his intelligent existence? Or have we, in the long mythical eras extending over hundreds of thousands of years and recorded in the chronologies of Chaldea and of China, shadowy mementos of prehistoric man, handed down by tradition and perhaps transported by a few survivors to existing lands from others which, like the fabled Atlantis of Plato, may have been submerged, or the scene of some great catastrophe which destroyed them with all their civilization? The 6 or 8 thousand years which the previous interpreters of the biblical record assign for the creation of the world and the duration of man upon the earth allow little enough space for the development of his civilization, a civilization which documental evidence carries almost to the verge of the limit. For the expansion and divergence of stocks, or the obliteration of the branches connecting them. But fortunately, we are no more compelled to fetter our belief within such limits as regards man than to suppose that his appearance on the globe was coeval with or immediately successive to its own creation at that late date. For while geological science, on the one hand, carries back the creation of the world, and the appearance of life upon its surface to a period so remote that it is impossible to estimate it, and difficult even to faintly approximate to it, so upon the other, the researches of paleontologists have successively tracked back the existence of man to periods variously estimated at from 30,000 to 1 million years, to periods when he coexisted with animals which have long since become extinct, and which even excelled in magnitude and ferocity most of those which in savage countries dispute his empire at the present day. Is it not reasonable to suppose that his combats with these would form the most important topic of conversation, of tradition, and of primitive song, and that graphic accounts of such struggles and of the terrible nature of the foes encountered would be handed down from father to son, with a fidelity of description and an accuracy of memory unsuspected by us, who, being acquainted with reading and writing, are led to defend upon their artificial assistance, and thus in a measure fail to cultivate a faculty which, in common with those of keenness of vision and hearing, are essential to the existence of man in a savage or semi-savage condition. I conceive that quite a large proportion of the most profound thinkers are satisfied to exert their memory very moderately. It is, in fact, a distraction from close thought to exert the memory overmuch, and a man engaged in the study of an abstruse subject will commonly rather turn to his bookshelves for the information he requires than tax his memory to supply it. R. A. Proctor, Pop Sci Monthly, January 1874. The illiterate backwoodsman or trapper, and hence by inference the savage or semi-civilized man, whose mind is occupied merely by his surroundings, and whose range of thought, in place of being diffused over a limited horizon, is confined with very moderate limits, develops remarkable powers of observation and an accuracy of memory in regard to localities and the details of his daily life, surprising to the scholar who has mentally to travel over so much more ground, and receiving daily so many and so far more complex ideas, can naturally grasp each less firmly, and is apt to lose them entirely in the haze of a period of time which would still leave those of the uneducated man distinguishable or even prominent landmarks. It was through one of these happy chances, so the Brothers Grimm wrote in 1819, that we came to make the acquaintance of a peasant woman of the village of Niederzwern, near Kassel, who told us the greater part of the Märchen of the second volume, and the most beautiful of it too. She held the old tales firmly in her memory, and would sometimes say that this gift was not granted to everyone, and that many a one could not keep anything in its proper connection. Anyone inclined to believe the tradition is easily corrupted or carelessly kept, and that therefore it could not possibly last long, should have heard how steadily she always abided by her record, and how she stuck to its accuracy. She never altered anything in repeating it, and if she made a slip, at once righted herself as soon as she became aware of it, in the very midst of her tale. The attachment to tradition among people living on in the same kind of life with unbroken regularity is stronger than we, who are fond of change, can understand. Odinic Songs in Shetland, Carl Blind, 19th Century, June 1879. Variations in traditions must, of course, occur in time, and the same histories, radiating in all directions from centers, vary from the original ones by increments dependent on proportionately altered phases of temperament and character, induced by change of climate, associations, and conditions of life, so that the early written history of every country reproduces under its own garb, and with a claim to originality, attenuated, enriched, or deformed versions of traditions common in their origin to many or all. See quotation from Gladstone, 19th century, October 1879. Stories of divine progenitors, demigods, heroes, mighty hunters, slayers of monsters, giants, dwarfs, gigantic serpents, dragons, frightful beasts of prey, supernatural beings, and myths of all kinds appear to have been carried into all corners of the world with as much fidelity as the sacred Ark of the Israelites, acquiring a molding, graceful, weird, or uncouth, according to the genius of the people or their capacity for superstitious belief. And these would appear to have been materially affected by some varied nature of their respective countries. For example, the long-continuing dwellers in the open plains of a semi-tropical region, relieved to a great extent from the cares of watchfulness and nurtured in the grateful rays of a genial but not oppressive sun, must have a more buoyant disposition and more open temperament than those inhabiting vast forests, the matted overgrowth of which rarely allows the passage of a single ray, bathes all in gloom, and leaves on every side undiscovered depths, filled with shapeless shadows, objects of vigilant dread, from which some ferocious monster may emerge at any moment. Again, on the one hand, the nomad roaming in isolation over vast solitudes, having much leisure for contemplative reflection, and on the other, the hardy dwellers on storm-beaten coasts. By turns, fishermen, mariners, and pirates must equally develop traits which affect their religion, polity, and customs, and stamp their influences on mythology and tradition. The Greek, the Celt, and the Viking descended from the same Aryan ancestors, though all drawing from the same sources, their inspirations of religious belief and tradition quickly diverged and respectively settled into a generous martial race. Martial in support of their independence rather than from any lust of conquests, polite, skilled, and learned. One brave but irritable, suspicious, haughty, impatient of control. And the last, the berserker, with a ruling passion for maritime adventure, piracy, and hand-to-hand heroic struggles, to be terminated in due course by a hero's death and a welcome to the banqueting halls of Odin in Valhalla. The beautiful mythology of the Greek nation, comprising a pantheon of gods and demigods, benign for the most part and often interesting themselves directly in the welfare of individual men, was surely due to, or at least greatly induced by, the plastic influences of a delicious climate, a semi-insular position in a sea comparatively free from stormy weather, and an open mountainous country moderately fertile. Again, the gloomy and sanguinary religion of the Druids was doubtless molded by the depressing influences of the seclusion, twilight haze, and dangers of the dense forests in which they hid themselves. Forests which, as we know from Caesar, spread over the greater part of Gaul, Britain, and Spain, while the Viking, having from the chance or choice of his ancestors, inherited a rugged seaboard, lashed by tempestuous waves and swept by howling winds, a seaboard with only a rugged country shrouded with unsubdued forests at its back, exposed during the major portion of the year to great severity of climate, and yielding, at the best, but a niggard and precarious harvest, became perforce a bold and skillful mariner, and translating his belief into a language symbolic of his new surroundings, believed that he saw and heard Thor in the midst of the howling tempests, revealed majestic and terrible through rents in the storm cloud. Pursuing our consideration of the effects produced by climatic conditions, may we not assume, for example, that some, at least, of the Chaldeans, inhabiting a pastoral country, and being descended from ancestors who had pursued for hundreds or thousands of years a nomadic existence in the vast open steppes of the highlands of Central Asia, were indebted to those circumstances for the advance which they are credited with having made in astronomy and kindred sciences? Is it not possible that their acquaintance with climatology was as exact or even more so than our own? The habits of solitude would induce reflection, the subject of which would naturally be the causes influencing the vicissitudes of weather. The possibilities of rain or sunshine, wind or storm, would be with them a prominent object of solicitude. And the necessity in an unfenced country of extending their watch over their flocks and herds throughout the night would perforce more or less rivet their attention upon the glorious constellations of the heavens above, and lead to habits of observation which, systematized and long continued by the priesthood, might have produced deductions accurate in the result, even if faulty in the process. The vast treasures of ancient knowledge tombed in the ruins of Babylon and Assyria, of which the recovery and deciphering is as yet only initiated, may to our surprise reveal that certain secrets of philosophy were known to the ancients equally with ourselves, but lost through intervening ages by the destruction of the empire, and the fact of their conservancy having been entrusted to a privileged and limited order with which it perished. Mr. C.P. Daly, president of the American Geographical Society, informs us in his annual address for 1880 that in one book found in the Royal Library at Nineveh of the date 2000 B.C., there is 1. A catalog of stars, 2. Enumeration of 12 constellations forming our present zodiac, 3. The intimation of a Sabbath, 4. A connection indicated, according to Mr. Purville, between the weather and the changes of the moon, 5. A notice of the spots on the sun, a fact that they could have known only by the aid of telescopes, which it is supposed they possessed from observations that they have noted down the rising of Venus, and the fact that Layard found a crystal lens in the ruins of Nineveh. N.B. As to the above, I must say that telescopes are not always necessary to see spots on the sun. These were distinctly visible with the naked eye in the early mornings to myself and the officers of the SS Scotia in the Red Sea in the month of August of 1883, after the great volcanic disturbances near Batavia. The resulting atmospheric effects were very marked in the Red Sea as elsewhere. The sun, when near the horizon, appealing of a pale green color and exhibiting the spots distinctly. We hail as a new discovery the knowledge of the existence of the so-called spots upon the surface of the sun, and scientists, from long-continued observations, profess to distinguish a connection between the character of these and atmospheric phenomena. They even venture to predict floods and droughts, and that for some years in anticipation. While pestilences or some great disturbance are supposed to be likely to follow the period when 3 or 4 planets attain their apogee within 1 year, a supposition based on the observations extended over numerous years that similar events had accompanied the occurrence of even one only of those positions at previous periods. May we not speculate on the possibility of similar or parallel knowledge having been possessed by the old Chaldean and Egyptian priesthood? And may not Joseph have been able, by superior ability in its exercise, to have anticipated the 7 years' drought, or Noah, from an acquaintance with meteorological science, to have made an accurate forecast of the great disturbances which resulted in the deluge and the destruction of a large portion of mankind? Ammianus Marcellinus, Book 22, Chapter 15, S20, in speaking of the pyramids, says, "There are also subterranean passages and winding retreats which, it is said, men skillful in the ancient mysteries, by means of which they divined the coming of a flood, constructed in different places, lest the memory of all their sacred ceremonies should be lost." As affording a minor example of prophecy, I quote a correspondence communication relating to Siam to the North China Daily News of July 28, 1881. "Singularly enough, the prevalence of cholera in Siam this season has been predicted for some months. The blossoming of the bamboo, which in India is considered the invariable forerunner of an epidemic, was looked upon as ominous, while the enormous quantity of high quality of the fruit produced was cited as pointing out the overcharge of the earth with matter which, though tending to the development of vegetable life, is deleterious to human. From these and other sources of knowledge open to those accustomed to read the book of nature, the prevalence of cholera, which since 1873 has been almost unknown in Siam, was predicted and looked for. And unlike most modern predictions, it has been certainly fulfilled," page 26. So common was the belief that when some months since a foreign official in Siamese employ applied for a leave of absence, it was opposed by some of the native officials on the ground that he ought to stay and take his chance of the cholera with the rest of them. Without further digression in a path which opens the most pleasing speculations and could be pursued into endless ramifications, I will merely, in conclusion,
suggest that the same influences which, as I have shown above, affect so largely the very nature of a people, must similarly affect its traditions and myths, and that due consideration will have to be given to such influences, in the case of some, at least, of the remarkable animals which I propose to discuss in this and future volumes. Chronological list of some authors writing on and works relating to natural history, to which references are made in the present volume, extracted to a great extent as to the Western authors from Knight's Cyclopedia of Biography. The Shanghai King, according to the commentator Kuo Po, AD 276-324. This work was compiled 3,000 years before this time, or at seven dynasties' distance. Yang, son of the Ming Dynasty, commencing AD 1368, states that it was compiled by Kong Chia and Cheng Ku from engravings of nine urns made by the Emperor Yu, B.C. 2255. Cheng Ku was an historiographer, and at the time of the last emperor of the Hyatt Dynasty, B.C. 1818, fearing that the emperor might destroy the books treating of the ancient and present time, carried them in flight to Yin. The Ruya, initiated, according to tradition, by Chao Kung, uncle of Wu Wang, the first emperor of the Chao Dynasty, B.C. 1122, ascribed also to Tse Hia, the disciple of Confucius. The bamboo books containing the ancient annals of China, said to have been found AD 279, and opening the grave of King Sang of Wei, died BC 295, age prior to last date undetermined, authenticity disputed, favored by Legge. Confucius, author of Spring and Autumn Classics, etc., BC 551-479. Ctesias, historian, physician to Artaxerxes, B.C. 401, Herodotus, B.C. 484, Aristotle, B.C. 384, Megasthenes, about B.C. 300, in time of Seleucus Nicator. His work entitled Indica is only known by extracts in those of Strabo, Arian, and Aelian. Aristoxenes, born B.C. 276, mathematician, astronomer, and geographer. Posidonius, born about B.C. 140, besides philosophical treatises, wrote works on geography, history, and astronomy, fragments of which are preserved in the works of Cicero, Strabo, and others. Nisander, about B.C. 135, wrote the Theriaca, a poem of 1,000 lines in hexameter, on the wounds caused by venomous animals and the treatment. Is followed in many of his errors by Pliny. Plutarch says the Theriaca cannot be called a poem because there is in it nothing of fable or falsehood. Strabo, just before the Christian era, geographer. Cicero, born B.C. 106. Propertius, Sextus Aurelius, born probably about B.C. 56. Theodorus Siculus wrote the Bibliotheca Historica in Greek, after the death of Julius Caesar, B.C. 44. Of the 40 books composing it, only 15 remain, viz. Books 1-5 and 11-20. Juba, died A.D. 17, son of Juba I, king of Numidia, wrote on natural history. Pliny, born A.D. 23. Lucan, A.D. 38. The only work of his extant is the Pharsalia, a poem on the civil war between Caesar and Pompey. Ignatius, either an early patriarch, AD 50, or patriarch of Constantinople, 799. Isidorus. Isidorus of Cherau lived probably in the first century of our era. He wrote an account of the Parthian Empire. Arian, born about AD 100, his work on the natural history, etc., of India, is founded on the authority of Aristophanes and Megasthenes. Pausanias, author of the description or itinerary of Greece in the 2nd century. Philostratus, born about AD 182. Solinus, Caius Julius, did not write in the Augustan age, for his work entitled Polyhistor is merely a compilation from Pliny's natural history. According to Salmasius, he lived about 200 years after Pliny.
alien, probably middle of the 3rd century AD, De Natura Animalium in Greek. Ammianus Marcellinus lived in the 4th century. Cardan Jerome A, about the end of the 4th century AD. Printing invented in China, according to Duhalde, AD 924. Block printing used in AD 593. Marco Polo reached the court of Kublai Khan in AD 1275. Mandeville, Sir John De, traveled for 33 years in Asia, dating from AD 1327. As he resided for 3 years in Peking, it is probable that many of his fables are derived from Chinese sources. Printing invented in Europe by John Coster of Haarlem, AD 1438. Scaliger, Julius Caesar, born April 23rd, 1484, wrote Aristotelis Hist Annum Liber Decimus Cum Ver et Comment, 8 volumes, Lyon, 1584, etc. Gesner, born 1516, Historia Animalium, etc. Ambrose Paré, born 1517, surgeon. Ballon-Pierre, born 1518, zoologist, geographer, etc. Aldrovandus, born 1552, naturalist. Tavernier, J.B., born 1605. Pan Cao Kongmo, by Li Shenqin of the Ming Dynasty, A.D. 1368-1628. Yuan Qian Li Han, A.D. 1718. Chapter 1. On Some Remarkable Animal Forms. The reasoning upon the question whether dragons, winged snakes, sea serpents, unicorns, and other so-called fabulous monsters have in reality existed, and at dates coeval with man, diverges in several independent directions. We have to consider, 1. Whether the characteristics attributed to these creatures are or are not so abnormal in comparison with those of known types as to render a belief in their existence impossible, or the reverse. 2. Whether it is rational to suppose that creatures so formidable and apparently so capable of self-protection should disappear entirely, while much more defenseless species continue to survive them. 3. The myths, traditions, and historical allusions from which their reality may be inferred require to be classified and annotated, and full weight given to the evidence which is accumulated of the presence of man upon the earth during ages long prior to the historic period, and which may have been ages of slowly progressive civilization, or perhaps cycles of alternate light and darkness, of knowledge and barbarism. And 4. Lastly, some inquiry may be made into the geographical conditions obtaining at the time of their possible existence. It is immaterial which of these investigations is first entered upon, and it will, in fact, be more convenient to defer a portion of them until we arrive at the sections of this volume treating specifically of the different objects to which it is devoted, and to confine our attention for the present to those subjects which, from their nature, are common and, in a sense, prefatory to the whole subject. I shall therefore commence with a short examination of some of the most remarkable reptilian forms which are known to have existed, and for that purpose, and to show their general relations, annex the accompanying tables compiled from the Anatomy of Vertebrated Animals by Professor Huxley. There are 2 pages of tables with lists, order, suborder, groups, illustrative genera, and range of the order, of mainly reptiles and dinosaurs. The most bird-like of reptiles, the pterosauria, appear to have possessed true powers of flight. They were provided with wings formed by an expansion of the integument and supported by an enormous elongation of the ulnar finger of the anterior limb. The generic differences are based upon the comparative lengths of the tail and upon the dentition. In Pterodactylus, the tail is very short and the jaws strong, pointed, and toothed to their anterior extremities. In Rhamphorhynchus, the tail is very long and the teeth are not continuous to the extremities of the jaws, which are produced into toothless beaks. The majority are small, and they are generally considered to have been inoffensive creatures, having much the habits and insectivorous mode of living of bats. One British species, however, from the White Chalk of Maidstone, measures more than 16 feet across the outstretched wings. And other forms recently discovered by Professor Marsh in the Upper Cretaceous deposits of Kansas attain the gigantic proportions of nearly 25 feet for the same measurements. And although these were devoid of teeth, thus approaching the Class A's still more closely, they could hardly fail, from their magnitude and powers of flight, to have been formidable and must, with their weird aspects and long outstretched necks and pointed heads, have been at least sufficiently alarming. We need go no further than these in search of creatures which would realize the popular notion of the winged dragon. The harmless little flying lizards belonging to the genus Draco, abounding in the East Indian archipelago, which have many of their posterior ribs prolonged into an expansion of the integument, unconnected with the limbs, and have a limited and parachute-like flight, need only the element of size to render them also sufficiently to be dreaded and capable of rivaling the pterodactyls and suggesting the general idea of the same monster. It is, however, when we pass to some of the other groups that we find ourselves in the presence of forms so vast and terrible as to more than realize the most exaggerated impression of reptilian power and ferocity which the florid imagination of man can conceive. We have long been acquainted with numerous gigantic terrestrial saurians ranging throughout the whole of the Mesozoic formations, such as Iguanodon, characteristic of the Wealden, Megalosaurus, Great Saurian, and Hylosaurus, Forest Saurian, huge, bulky creatures, the last of which at least was protected by dermal armor partially produced into prodigious spines, as well as with remarkable forms essentially marine, such as Ichthyosaurus, fish-like saurian, Plesiosaurus, etc., adapted to an oceanic existence and propelling themselves by means of paddles. The latter, it may be remarked, was furnished with a long, slender, swan-like neck, which carried above the surface of the water would present the appearance of the anterior portion of a serpent. To the related landforms, the collective term Dinosauria, from Dinos or Dinos, terrible, has been applied in signification of the power with which their structure and magnitude imply that they possessed, and to the others that of Enalosauria, as expressive of their adaptation to a maritime existence. Yet, wonderful to relate, those creatures which have for so many years commanded our admiration fade into insignificance in comparison with others which are proved, by the discoveries of the last few years, to have existed abundantly upon or near to the American continent during the Cretaceous and Jurassic periods, by which they are surpassed in point of magnitude, as much as they themselves exceed the mass of the larger vertebrata. Take, for example, those referred to by Professor Marsh in the course of an address to the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1877 in the following terms.
The reptiles most characteristic of our American Cretaceous strata are the Mosasauria, a group with very few representatives in other parts of the world. In our Cretaceous seas, they rule supreme, as their numbers, size, and carnivorous habits enabled them to easily vanquish all rivals. Some were at least 60 feet in length, and the smallest 10 or 12. In the inland Cretaceous Sea from which the Rocky Mountains were beginning to emerge, these ancient sea serpents abounded, and many were entombed in its muddy bottom. On one occasion, as I rode through a valley washed out of this old ocean bed, I saw no less than 7 different skeletons of these monsters in sight at once. The Mosasauria were essentially swimming lizards with 4 well-developed paddles, and they had little affinity with modern serpents to which they have been compared.
Or again, notice the specimens of the genus Clarastes, which are also described as veritable sea serpents of those ancient seas, whose huge bones and almost incredible number of vertebrae shows them to have attained a length of nearly 200 feet. The remains of no less than 10 of these monsters were seen by Professor Mudge while riding through the Mauvais Terre of Colorado, strewn upon the plains, their whitened bones bleached in the suns of centuries, and their gaping jaws armed with ferocious teeth, telling a wonderful tale of their power when alive. The same deposits have been equally fertile in the remains of terrestrial animals of gigantic size. The Titanosaurus montanus, believed to have been herbivore, is estimated to have reached 50 or 60 feet in length, while other dinosaurians of still more gigantic proportions, from the Jurassic beds of the Rocky Mountains, have been described by Professor Marsh. Among the discovered remains of Atlantosaurus immensus is a femur over 6 feet in length, and is estimated from a comparison of this specimen with the same bone in living reptiles that this species, if similar in proportions to the crocodile, would have been over 100 feet in length. But even yet, the limit has not been reached, and we hear of the discovery of the remains of another form of such titanic proportions as to possess a thigh bone over 12 feet in length. From these considerations, it is evident that on account of the dimensions usually assigned to them, no discredit can be attached to the existence of the fabulous monsters of which we shall speak hereafter. For these and the various myths rarely or never equal in size creatures which science shows to have existed in a comparatively recent geological age, while the quaintest conception could hardly equal the reality of yet another of the American dinosaur, Stegosaurus, which appears to have been herbivore and more or less aquatic in habit, adapted for sitting upon its hinder extremities and protected by a bony plate and numerous spines, it reached 30 feet in length. Professor Marsh considers that this, when alive, must have presented the strangest appearance of all the dinosaurs yet discovered. Figure 5 shows monster bones of extinct gigantic saurians from Colorado, showing relative proportions to corresponding bone in the crocodile. A from the Scientific American. The affinities of birds and reptiles have been so clearly demonstrated of late years as to cause Professor Huxley and many other comparative anatomists to bridge over the wide gap which was formerly considered to divide the two classes and to bracket them together in one class, to which the name Sauropsidae has been given. It is now generally admitted by biologists who have made a study of the vertebrata that birds have come down to us through the dinosaurs, and the close affinity of the latter with recent Struthious birds will hardly be questioned. The case amounts almost to a demonstration if we compare with dinosaurs their contemporaries, the Mesozoic birds. The classes of birds and reptiles as now living are separated by a gulf so profound that a few years since it was cited by the opponents of evolution as the most important break in the animal series, and one which that doctrine could not bridge over. Since then, as Huxley has clearly shown, this gap has been virtually filled by the discoveries of bird-like reptiles and reptilian birds. Compsognathus and Archaeopteryx of the Old World and Ichthyornis and Hesperornis of the New are the stepping stones by which the evolutionist of today leads the doubting brother across the shallow remnant of the gulf, once thought impassable. Marsh. Figure 6. Silvatherium restored from the upper Miocene deposits of the Siwalak Hills after Figuier. There are indeed not a few remarkable forms as to the class position of which, whether they should be assigned to birds or reptiles, opinion was of a long time, and is in a few instances still divided. It is, for example, only late years that the fossil form Archaeopteryx, figure 4, page 19, from the Sloenhofen slate, has been definitely relegated to the former, but arguments against this disposal of it have been based upon the beak or jaws being furnished with true teeth, and the feather of the tail attached to a series of vertebrae, instead of a single flattened one as in birds. Professor Carl Vogt regards the Archaeopteryx as neither reptile nor bird, but as constituting an intermediate type. He points out that there is complete homology between the scales or spines of reptiles and the feathers of birds. The feather of the bird is only a reptile's scale further developed, and the reptile's scale is a feather which has remained in the embryonic condition. He considers the reptilian homologies to preponderate. It appears to have been entirely plumed and to have had a moderate power of flight. On the other hand, the Ornithopterus is only provisionally classed with reptiles, while the connection between the two classes is drawn still closer by the copious discovery of the birds from the Cretaceous formations of America, for which we are indebted to Professor Marsh. Figure 7 is a skeleton of the Megatherium, after Figier. The Lepidosiren also is placed midway between reptiles and fishes. Professor Owen and other eminent physiologists consider it a fish. Professor Bischoff and others an amphibian reptile. It has a twofold apparatus for respiration, partly aquatic, consisting of gills, and partly aerial of true lungs. So far, then, as abnormality of type is concerned, we have here instances quite as remarkable as those presented by most of the strange monsters, with the creation of which mythological fancy has been credited. Among mammals, I shall only refer to the Megatherium, which appears to have been created to burrow in the earth and to feed upon the roots of trees and shrubs, for which purpose every organ of its heavy frame was adapted. This Hercules among animals was as large as an elephant or rhinoceros of the largest species, and might well, as it has existed until a late date, have originated the myths current among the Indians of South America, of a gigantic tunneling or burrowing creature, incapable of supporting the light of day. Figure 8 shows a Dinotherium, after Figier. A similar habit is ascribed by the Chinese to the mammoth and to the gigantic Civetherium, figure 6, page 39, a four-horned stag, which had the bulk of an elephant and exceeded it in height. It was remarkable for being in some respects between the stags and the pachyderms. The Dinotherium, figure 8, which had a trunk like an elephant and two inverted tusks, presented in its skull a mixture of the characteristics of the elephant, hippopotamus, tapir, and dugong. Its remains occur in the Miocene of Europe.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.